Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. This year, 2014, marks the centennial of Oklahoma artist Alan Houser, a Chiricahua Apache whose father fought with and was closely related to Geronimo. Today, Houser's art is seen by practically every Oklahoman on a daily basis, most of the time, though, without even knowing it. Sacred Rain Arrow, which greets visitors upon arrival at Gilchrist Museum, is the sculpture featured on Oklahoma car tags. In fact, just in the last month, that artwork was the subject of a recently dismissed religious freedom lawsuit within the state. But Sacred Rain Arrow is just one of nearly 1,000 sculptures in stone, wood, and bronze Houser created, mostly in the last 30 years of his life, after decades of teaching as well as creating art at the Intermountain Indian School and the Institute of American Indian Arts in Santa Fe. Today, his work is well-respected and collected in some prestigious foreign institutes like the Japanese and British Royal Collections, the Pompidou Center in Paris, American museums like the Smithsonian's National Portrait Gallery, the American Art Museum, and the Museum of American Indian, as well as collections around the country, including both Gilchrist and Philbrook here in Tulsa. Gilchrist Museum opened a centennial exhibition devoted to Alan Houser over the weekend, Form and Line. Alan Houser's sculpture and drawing is on display through June 29th, which features a great number of his sculptures, but also his drawing skills as well, in a series of charcoal and pastel drawings. My guest today is the Associate Curator of Art at Gilchrist Museum, Carol Klein, to join us to talk about the impact and work of Alan Houser. Carol Klein, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich. I'm very happy to be here.
I'm very happy to have you here. And Gilchrist has just opened a new exhibit as part of one of institutions across the state that are celebrating the centennial of Alan Houser. Now, people who know art in our state will probably recognize that name, but they probably don't recognize the fact that you're seeing Alan Houser art anytime you get in your car. And that's because his Sacred Rain Arrow on our license plates, that comes from him. Mm-hmm. But, of course, he's much more than that, and it's really an amazing artist. In fact, I think it gives a sense of how important Alan Houser is to Gilchrist, because you see that Sacred Rain Arrow before you walk in the door, and one of the first pieces of art you see when you do walk in the door is another sculpture mm-hmm. by Alan Houser. Give us a sense of the importance of Houser's art on the West and on American art.
Well, I think Alan Houser's art, first of all, is very dignified. It's beautiful. I believe it exhibits his background and his pride in his heritage. The work presents his feelings about his past, his parents. He was the first Chiricahua Apache artist born into freedom after 27 years of captivity for his tribe. And I think that freedom that his parents had gained for him became a very important motivation for his life and his art. I think he once said it is the reason he became an artist.
Now, explain that idea of freedom, because the Chiricahua were native to actually southeastern Arizona.
Right.
We think of Geronimo. We think mm-hmm. of other of those last Indian wars. This was the fight the government was doing against that particular group of Indians. And, of course, once mm-hmm. they were subdued, they were brought to southwestern Oklahoma.
They were actually shipped different places. They were by train. They were in Florida, Alabama, and Fort Sill. And the Fort Sill group are the descendants of those Chiricahuas who were originally in Arizona and New Mexico.
But you said he was born into freedom.
They were in captivity for 27 years. Uh-huh. And actually, he's a great nephew of Geronimo. His father, Sam, was on the warpath with Geronimo. So from a very hard life that he heard stories of from his parents, I believe it was only 3 months after they moved to an allotment of land north of Lawton that Alan was born. And he grew up on a farm that his father established on that 160 acres. And I think in his art, he lived out that freedom that his parents had gained, basically.
Mm-hmm. One of the amazing things about Alan Houser's art is it really shows the breadth of art during his time, because mm-hmm. he could be incredibly abstract, mm-hmm. yet He had a number of thematic elements that were always reflected in that abstraction. Right. So, and you could see that also in his figurative forms. I mean, you could see this whole range from absolutely figurative to absolutely abstract, but the forms and the statements he was making in his sculpture were always the same. Mm-hmm. He was also expert at doing two-dimensional, what we call two-dimensional Native mm-hmm. American art, as well as having depth and perspective right. from a European approach in those same themes. So he was a tremendously versatile artist.
Yes, very talented. And I believe he began at an early age drawing and carving. In fact, the story is he carved soap, and his mother got very upset with him because he had used her good soap to make a carving. But yes, at the age of 20, he began studying in Santa Fe with Dorothy Dunn, and that was the traditional flat-style Native American tempera paintings, at which he was wonderful. Gilcrease has about a dozen of those. They're not on display in this exhibit, but they have been off and on display. He went through a period of working in transparent watercolor, which had more three-dimension and depth, more of that European perspective aspect. I think he began to really realize that he loved art in the round, so he began sculpting more, and I think found his passion in that. And I think the older that he got and transformed over that 50-year career, the freer he felt, in a sense, to pursue whatever those inner directives were telling him.
Now, one of the things that shows up time and time again as far as thematic material is what I would call the Madonna and Child.
Yes.
Although it shows up as an Indian mother and child. Right. Was he influenced by that whole European tradition of Madonna and Child, or was this something that he sort of came upon independently and then all of a sudden, oh, this fits in this framework?
I think there's probably both, but I do know that he was very close to his mother. He admired his mother very much, and I think that that sense of family and that sense of nurturing really came out in these particular themes. And he does have a lot of figurative works in this exhibit, probably mostly figurative. And there are a number of women and children in this. There are also some animals. There's a few warriors, a dancer, a buffalo. There's a wonderful eagle called the Force, which has nestled within it.
Yeah, it's a Madonna so it's child a, in a, yeah, its own way.
It's still this theme.
And you know, that was done, I guess, in the 1980s, I think, but it almost looks like some of the stylized things you saw in the 1930s, where it was still figurative, but you were starting to see, you know, this less of a representational view. Right. It's almost like a stylized eagle in many senses. And, of course, it has that traditional Allan Houser form, which has this wonderful flowing. I always call it like it's the Shaw with the face. Mm-hmm. And that shows up time and time again. How did he come up on that form? Do we know? Is there scholarship into how that became?
I don't know. I think Allan, you know, Allan was very adamant, in a sense, of finding out who Allan was. And I think he reached down deep within himself to follow whatever, you know, his muse in whatever direction it took him. And he says time and again that the themes of his work are based on the stories he was told by his family, you know, from the hardships that they came from, and the fact that he could be that free and, you know, at a time and rise from that type of prejudice. And he also had a very good sense of himself. He commanded high prices. He felt that his work was fine art. He defined it as such, and he never sold out, basically. I mean, he commanded good prices to raise a family and to become who he could become.
And I think that idea of I am an artist that does mm-hmm. Native American art, not necessarily a Native American artist, sort of shows up. I mean, because mm-hmm. there's a sense of experimentation that follows throughout his work. And he could come back and work very figuratively, and within, say, the same year, he's mm-hmm. working on something that mm-hmm. looks like it came out of Henry Moore's studio.
Right. Yes, and he was influenced by Henry Moore. There actually is a piece in the exhibit that has a hole through it, and, you know, you always think of Henry Moore related, you know, to that particular aspect, that a feature of the painting is not just the material itself, but the absence of the material.
But always Native. The thematic material is related to Native Americans. It always is.
It is.
It has that.
Right.
But it's adopting all sorts of European techniques to tell that story. And it shows what a master he was at adapting to all these different types. I mean, you have to remember the Sacred Rain Arrow, the image that's on our license plate that's in front. It's 1998. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is at the end of his life. And I think this is one of the interesting things you'll see in this show is how versatile he was throughout his life and the fact that most of this work was created after retirement.
Yes, and he was not only versatile in his stylistic changes, but because he also used many mediums over his lifetime. I mean, many types of stone. He experimented, of course, with bronze, but with welded steel. And some of those are totally amazing as well. We don't have those particular ones in this exhibit.
Because they're huge, for the most
they're
part.
They're huge. And, but you can see those, you know, elsewhere. And but what I love is also the different stones that he used, alabaster, marble.
A variety of marbles, too. It's almost like a
black
marble.
Yeah. Yeah, and those are beautiful. But also, his treatment of the surfaces is wonderful because you have some very smooth parts and then this very textured treatment that he did with the stone. And those things together are just gorgeous. You almost want to, you know, reach out and touch him, which, of course, you're not supposed to do, but you have that inclination.
And you get the sense from the way his care that if he was selling it to an individual, he would expect that individual to touch it and feel that tactile sense of it.
Absolutely.
Well, Gilcrease Museum is presenting the show Form and Line, Alan Hauser's Sculpture and Drawing. It's on display through June 29th. My guest today is Carol Klein, the Associate Curator of Art at Gilcrease. So tell us a little bit about the collection that makes up Form and Line. It comes from the Alan Hauser Foundation itself, right?
Yes. Apparently, I've heard so many things, I have not gotten to go there myself, to the park, but Alan Hauser Studio and Park, the complex in Santa Fe, is supposed to be absolutely wonderful, where you can walk among all these sculptures in different types of weather and so forth, but most of them are borrowed from Alan Hauser, Inc. And as I mentioned, there's different stones. There are several massive, fairly large pieces in the center of two of our small rooms that are amazing. One of them is a crouching figure who is gazing upward, and he's almost suspended in a moment between this total stillness and you feel like he's about to spring up, and that is just an amazing experience to stand there and look at that. Also, I feel that our technicians have done a wonderful job in presenting these sculptures. The room is very dark, and so when you walk in, the walls basically disappear in the first room where many of the sculptures are. Each sculpture is lit individually, and they are all pretty much oriented toward the viewer as they walk in. And in a sense, you feel like you're entering a sacred space, and all of these figures, these faces and people, are looking at you. It's almost like things are reversed. You know you're looking at them, but it's like it's just turned. The tables are turned. And it's an awesome experience.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about some of the pieces people will see. You mentioned you worked with Alabaster, Apache Mother, again, another Madonna figure, but this is a standing Madonna figure with a baby in the arms. Again, Alabaster, I can't imagine it's the easiest medium to work in. Is it a good sculptural stone?
I think it is a good sculptural stone. Obviously, I mean, he did a lot of work in alabaster. Marble, I think would be difficult, but he's just as adept in any of them. And what I love about some of them, too, is not only texture that he created, but the texture that's left behind by the tools themselves. Just almost inadvertently, where he's, you know, forming these shapes and volume.
Yeah. Of course, the smoothness of marble is you know, it's something to behold when you know that it is a carved form that has created it.
Absolutely.
And there's a number of those. The Comforting Touch, which I think has that black marble, which is just exquisite.
It's exquisite.
I imagine in the proper lighting, it just looks just
it's
amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They are truly beautiful.
Of course, it's not only sculpture that's a part of this show.
No.
You have a lot of charcoal drawings and pastels that are a part of this, and you get a sense that here was a guy who was, sculpture was what we know him for, but he was adept at any medium he attempted. He was a complete artist.
He was an artist. And he drew and sketched his entire life from a child. But I think a lot of the reason he was drawing and sketching for the most part was in preparation and thinking of sculpture. We have some sketchbooks on exhibit that are open to pages where you can actually see his visual thinking. I mean, they're totally amazing little vignettes. There's actually one for Sacred Rain Arrow, the upper torso. And that's beautiful to see that and then think, oh my gosh, that is Sacred Rain Arrow. That's the concept for it. There are also some large finished charcoal drawings, as you referred to. And some of these were done late in his life, several years even before he died. I can imagine that probably later in his life, maybe sculpting these large stone pieces got more difficult. And he made a comment that he was re-energizing and seeing drawing as an end in itself. So you can tell from these particular drawings that they're very finished and very different from the quick gestural
sort of study pieces. Yeah.
Yes.
And so I assume some of the drawings are conceptual pieces for what would end up being sculptures, right?
There are, for the most part, you don't always recognize the actual piece, but they're the themes. And there's one that's pretty close to a mother and child whose skirt. It's gorgeous. The skirt sort of goes sideways like it's blowing in the wind. That's what I love about his work is this contrast between a mother and child that's very, you know, stable and solid and kind of sort of cubist. And then you have one next to that whose hair is flowing in the wind and it's all rounded. And you can see these two things side by side. And
well, I think that's the interesting thing because a lot of times artists have a form that they're particularly drawn to. Mm-hmm. And it seems like, you know, his form changes depending on the mood of the day because you'll see these very much rounded forms, almost like a mound, if you will.
Right.
With, again, a lot of times it's the shawl over the body, mm-hmm. very smooth, very rounded mm-hmm. face. It's vertical. And then all of a sudden you'll see another form where it's absolutely horizontal. It goes against the grain for what we think of modern art because modern art, usually there's a tendency to do one to excess. And it seems like with him, it was just whatever mood hit him that day was the way he was going to go. And he was an expert draftsman. He was able to accomplish what his ideas in his head were in three dimensions with sculpture.
Absolutely. And it takes a lot of courage to do that as well. I mean, he didn't do the same thing over and over to sell. He constantly challenged the market, you know, but was very successful. And I think it just goes back to that, be who you are. And that's what he felt he needed to do and wanted to do.
And I think some of the interesting, I know there's a couple examples in the show where you see very abstract form. But if you've seen his figurative work, you know exactly what you're looking at. Mm-hmm. You're looking, again, at this shod form, but it's done in a totally abstract way.
Right. Yeah, there's one in particular that's a reclining figure, and it looks almost like a cocoon with a face on the end. And it's just this restful, and you know it's somehow incubating. You know, it's amazing to look at it. Almost to me, the word promise comes to mind, like it's going to evolve into something like a butterfly or, you know, whatever cocoons do, but change and morph just like he did.
My guest today is Carol Klein, the Associate Curator of Art at Gilcrease Museum. Gilcrease is presenting Form and Line, Alan Hauser's and Sculptures and Drawings on display through June 29th as a part of the Alan Hauser Centennial. Alan Hauser is a native Oklahoman, this is the centennial year, 2014. And of course, Gilcrease owns a number of Alan Hauser works, but this is really featuring works from the Alan Hauser Foundation, yes. Which is in Santa Fe. And of course, he was a great teacher as well. He influenced a great number of artists, first at I think it was a Navajo boarding school, and then later at the American mm-hmm. Institute for Indian Arts in Santa Fe. And of course, you know, we think of this great output, but a lot of it really happened only after he retired from teaching. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there was a couple of years where he was a Guggenheim Fellow, so he was able mm-hmm. to devote full time to work, but it was always after hours when he was working as an artist until retirement, when all of a sudden there's this just a huge explosion. I don't know if it's he'd been waiting for retirement to for this huge explosion of work, but when we think of Alan Houser, nearly all of the important works that are shown around the world come from that period after retirement.
Well, and I think that he always found time to work. Like you said, he did it at night, particularly, you know, when he had to move his family to Los Angeles when he was first married. He worked as a pipe fitter's assistant. But that's when he went to all these museums and was influenced by the modernists. And we know that he worked at night on his art during that period. And, of course, it makes sense. You know, I think when an artist teaches, I think he resolves a lot of things within himself, too, about his own process. And I think that those experiences help form what he does with his own work. And then, of course, by the time he was retired, he was a mature artist. So naturally, having that time then, you know, causes that type of production.
I think the thing that gets to me, though, is a lot of times when you see innovation, it's as a young man or a young artist. Mm-hmm. A young artist will have the innovation, and yet the innovation is happening in this very mature phase of his life.
Yes.
When he has the time and experience to focus fully on his art. And,
right.
Of course, it's our luxury.
Exactly. It is.
Well, for those who come to the Gilcrease and see this exhibit, talk about a couple of standout pieces people should look at and what they should look for when they're looking.
Well, I think one of the most impressive pieces is right when you walk in the exhibit, turn right around the corner, and it's called The Force, and it's the white stone eagle that I mentioned earlier, a fairly large piece, tabletop though. There's a very interesting buffalo that sort of presents a contrast from all the figures that are in that room. And it is very textured in its treatment. The stone that it stands on has a treatment that looks actually like prairie grass, which is just beautiful. And he just does it by incising these lines into this block of stone. It's just amazing. I think that's a really good contrast. And those two pieces are
and you have texture on the buffalo as well, or is it a smooth?
Texture on the buffalo as well. And there's some smooth areas too, but the treatment, the simplicity of the treatment of the grass that just reminds you of the prairie that's coming up below his feet and around his feet just sort of really impressed me. You know, just and that's what I love about Houser is how he was able to simplify and just get the essence of what the subject was.
And of course, he's carving.
Less
too.
Less is more.
And of course, he's carving too. And that's the whole thing. He's not even molding and bronze. It's carving.
He's carving.
Which one slip and.
Yeah. Yes.
And you're looking at Buffalo de Milo, I guess.
Yeah. A good point.
It is an amazing exhibit. Among his figurative work, the two-dimensional work, drawings and pastels, what are some of the standouts there?
There's one of a woman and child that reminds me of one of the sculptures that's in the show, so I think that's a good comparison. The pastels are amazing. They're very strong colors, primary reds and oranges, and I think there's a warrior on a horse that's done in charcoal. And what really impressed me about that piece, some of them have this softness of the treatment. That particular one, the warrior on horse, is done with a lot of lines in there, just very energetic, and he forms the depth, the blacks and lighter, you know, grays and so forth, with these lines, just how the density of how many lines there are. And just that particular linear treatment lends an energy to that work that just makes you want to stand there and, you know, you just feel drawn to it.
All right. Well, the Alan Houser Centennial continues all this year. You can see Alan Houser's work every day as you drive in your car, but the better way would be to go see Form and Line, Alan Houser's sculpture and drawing, on display at Gilcrease through June 29th. Carol, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
Carol Klein is the Associate Curator of Art at Gilcrease Museum. The museum is presenting a centennial exhibition of Oklahoma artist Alan Houser, Form in Line, Alan Hauser Sculpture and Drawing, which will be on display at the museum through June 29th. More information at gilcrease.org. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. Here's the comments of Barry Friedman.
Two fathers, two sons. How much longer do I have, Ben? My father asks. How much longer? He's not being maudlin. He's not sick. He's not asking rhetorically. He's a retired accountant. He really wants a number. It's his birthday. Sons of aging men engage in sort of a dress rehearsal for the day when we'll know that number, for the flights and the arrangements that will have to be made for the, in my father's case, honoring his wish to be buried in a cemetery on the south shore of Long Island, New York. He lives in Vegas, near his wife. I don't care what. You get me back to your mother. My father turned 87 on Monday. Brian's dad just turned 99. Brian and I wait for that call that will tell us that his dad, my dad, went in his sleep, had a stroke in the kitchen, was sitting at a blackjack table, had just come back from lunch. Brian and I have thought about the photo albums we'll go through and the closets that will have to be cleaned and which of the siblings will get which of the big screens and the purple hearts. Brian and I know we did our best, though we also know how much we missed, particularly finding out who the men were who were our fathers. Death changes everything, as I've said before, except the relationship. There was the line in On Golden Pond when Ethel says to Chelsea, "Your father is 80 years old. He has heart palpitations and has trouble remembering things. Just when do you want this friendship to begin?" Last time I saw my father, I asked if he ever thought about dying. "No, a little, yeah." On Monday, on my father's birthday, he had his carpets cleaned, had blood drawn to see how long it takes to clot, and got a free buffet at one of the casinos. On Monday, on my father's birthday, Brian's dad was visited by a hospice nurse. My friend knows the day is coming. I know the day is coming. My friend. Why do I call him that? Brian and I have never met, don't know each other except for Facebook. We met through a friend of a friend of a friend on a political blog. Brian posts about his dad. I do the same. He worries about my dad. I worry about his. Neither father knows a thing about Facebook, but are both local legends on it, as they should be. Nobody has met anybody. We're different sons of different fathers. Still, we're brothers. Christ, my carpets were dirty, my father tells me. 87! 87! It's been the same inflection for years. I remember 79, 79, 84, 84. On Monday, on my father's birthday, Brian posted this about his dad. He calls him Stud Puppet. Stud Puppet, to the nurse. "You have a real high voice. I can't make out what you're saying." Claudia, the nurse. "I'm sorry, I know. I will try harder so you understand me." Stud Puppet. "That's all right. I don't mind. You have a real nice figure." Yeah. It's good being a son. It will always be good.
Barry Friedman is a writer, essayist, and columnist for the Tulsa Voice and a regular contributor to Studio Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.